everyone was enacting its law, the king would push his hand's imprint in the clay tablets. And then fingerprints were later on also used. And another example is around 1850, where in the British Indies there was a problem of double payment of workers who came to present second, maybe third, and more times to get pay for their work. And there was an Englishman, Mr. Herstel, who was thinking of the idea to let them put their fingerprint on the backside of the documents, so at least that it would be a deterrent for coming and presenting a second time to get be paid for the same work. And biometrics have also been used here in Europe now, but also, I would say, early 1900s for immigrants, fingerprinting immigrants. There is a nice story described in the book of Cole, History of Fingerprints, where he describes that during the gold rush in California, law was enacted to have all these Chinese immigrants who came by train into California to have them fingerprinted. So biometrics is not new, and it is fascinating. It's developing all the time. But I would say the strength and the use of biometrics, namely the fact that it can be used to identify someone, may be also one of the greatest risks and pitfalls. So precisely the strength of biometric can be its risks, its weaknesses. So we have to be very careful because they can be very powerful. Just think of all those who have traveled to the US since December 2008. You have all left your 10 fingerprints. It's collected and stored there. So it is very powerful in its use, in its reuse, and it can also be misused. So I will explain some of the reuse cases where there are pitfalls which you need to pay attention for to avoid the risks. So first of all, the use of biometrics for forensics. I think it's important that we just keep in mind that biometric data for forensic science in some way escape our base regulation in Europe for the protection of personal data. And you see on my slide this basis, the ground regulation, the Lex Generalis, as we say, is a directive that was adopted in 1995. So 1995, Europe adopted a directive which is still today in use and valid. And this directive contains basic principles about the use of data that can be connected, linked to persons. So it gives basic principles on how to use personal data as defined therein. And three important principles that are also important for today's discussion are reflected in this directive. And one of the basic ideas is that if you use and collect personal data, data that relate to an identified or an identifiable person, that you have to define for what purpose you're going to use this. So purpose specification is a key principle in current data protection legislation. So purpose specification is very important and is an issue in many applications, as I will explain later. Two other principles I like to stress in this directive are the fact that it has to be transparent about what use you're going to make. So transparency, which will include information to the persons whose data you collect, and also the possibility of the persons to have access to their data. So these are three principles, the most important only. There are many others, but I'm not going to discuss it now. And precisely these three principles are not applied in very specific cases. And these cases are so-called public interest cases, where exemptions exist from purpose specification, information, and access. They are set together in an Article 13, and they state that an Article 13 states that member states can provide in their legislation exemptions from these three principles in national law. And the reasons or the public interest cases are national security, which is a concept that is hardly definable in legal terms. So national security, also defense, public security, it's maybe easier to define, but also the prevention, investigation, and the prosecution of crime. So use of personal data for the prevention, investigation, and prosecution of criminal offenses are exempted or can be exempted by national law from the principles or global framework of data protection as set out in Directive 95. So, as a result, I come to the fact that using personal data for forensic science, for law enforcement, is a matter of national law. It's not a matter of the Directive 95, but it's a matter of national law. So what do we have? We have 28 member states defining in their own criminal law code or book when they can collect biometric data, how they can store it, who has access to biometric data. Several member states have adopted already specific legislation referring to biometric data. If the member states are not yet fully up to speed, it may even be that criminal code has no reference to biometric data collection and use. And it can even be that it is more guidelines or unwritten law. For example, if someone is arrested, convicted, and put in jail, there may be merely guidelines to the prosecutors that when someone is put in jail, it's better, or they have to put their fingerprint before they put in jail the face. So, for example, in Belgium, this practice of fingerprinting convicts is based on mere guidelines. So you have national law, criminal law on one hand about collection of biometric data, and then also criminal procedure. How can you use this information for evidence purposes? So national law is very important, and if we want to have the whole picture, it is important to know that I just told you that this basic directive is not applicable for law enforcement use of personal data, but there is some EU regulation, I would say it's a decision of 2008, but which merely regulates the exchange of personal data between law enforcement authorities. It is not imposing rules on how the national authorities have to handle the data, but only when exchanging. It's a very, very limited scope. And for example, one of the principles in this decision is that if you exchange, it has to be very purpose-specific for very clearly defined purposes. So these principles come back in this decision of 2008. And then for the rest, I would say, especially if we look at biometric data, we have specific EU regulation which govern large-scale EU systems which contain biometric data. And examples are Eurodac system, which contains biometric data, fingerprint from asylum seekers, and the visum information system. So besides national law, the framework decision, and very specific legislation, we have a few of some international treaties which need to be respected as well. But that is basically the framework for the use of data for forensic science. And that is good to keep that in mind. However, very important, I think, and that is what I want to talk about a little bit more, and it's about the so-called harmonized fundamental rights of privacy and data protection. These rights, fundamental rights, they have been established in 2007 in a Charter of Fundamental Rights for Europe. It was a charter, and it has become effective with the signing of the Lisbon Treaty, signed on 13 December 2007, and in effect only on the 1st of December 2009. So in fact, it's a system that merely exists for 5 years, I would say. And it's interesting to know that in fact the initial idea was to put fundamental rights in a constitution for Europe. So during the presidency of Belgium in 2000, very eminent persons set together and started to draft a constitution for Europe. So they started a list with fundamental rights. And fundamental rights, these are rights which, in a general idea, apply to all people, notwithstanding place or time, which are like a lex naturalis, that have force in themselves because they have to apply. So this constitution was, in the years thereafter, provided to the member states who had to accept the constitution, but it was rejected in several member states, for example, also in France. So the idea of putting all these fundamental rights together in a constitution was not possible. So some clever people have thereafter got the idea of putting all these rights in this charter. And this charter was part of the Lisbon Treaty, and Lisbon, which entails a reform, an important reform of the institutions in Europe, also contains a very explicit reference to the Charter. And Article 6 on the Treaty of European Union states the rights in the Fundamental Charter have the same legal value as the international treaties, which means that the rights are really put at the highest level to be respected by all EU member states, just as the EU treaties, and prevailing above all national laws. So, charter and the rights therein of privacy and data protection really at the top level of our legal order. And you may say, okay, what changed with the situation before? What is so important about that? And I think it is really important, and we only start to realize right now, and we will see and see the effects of that in the years to come. We have seen it last year in some important developments, and we will see more of that in the next years to come. Why? Because before this evolution, we also had already in Europe done this exercise of fundamental rights. It was after World War II. People had really suffered in many ways. So there was a whole development of, again, codifying the important laws which are valuable for all the people. And there was this first on UN, United Nations level, that rights of privacy was codified. And then a couple of years later in Europe, the Council of Europe, where European countries, again, in Article 8 of the European Convention for Human Rights, already put the right to privacy. So it exists from 1950. So you can say, why is it now so important that we have now this charter? It already existed. But I think there are some very important differences where Article 8, between Article 8 and these two new Articles 7 and 8 of the Charter. For example, Article 8 was an article that was also to be implemented by all the member states of the Council of Europe, but a person who found that his right to privacy was not respected first had to go through all the procedures before the courts in its own country before, if he could not the right recognized, before he could go to the court in Strasbourg for having Article 8 applied. So it really meant a long, long, only for the powerful ones, to bring your case before the court of Strasbourg. Was one reason, or it is one reason, why we have, of course, some cases, but maybe fewer cases than you could expect. A second difference is that you could also only bring a claim against a state under Article 8, because the European Convention of Human Rights, the idea is these rights are only rights that citizens need against a state, and not necessarily between two individuals, or between an individual and a company. So you have already this more limited scope. And then also, the procedural question was that you first, until 1998, had to go through procedure of the Commission for Human Rights to see whether your claim was acceptable. And also, importantly, fourthly, is that Article 8 was just about the right to privacy. And it's only about several years that it included also an idea that it should cover protection for personal data. And I give you an example. For example, an example was a case about a man who was demonstrating in Vienna, in Austria, in the, I think, the end of the 80s. And right of demonstration is also a right to do, but this person was put aside by the police and his face image was taken and his identity was controlled, his name and other personal details were taken down. And this person felt that Article 8 was not respected. So he did the whole procedure up to Strasbourg. And the court there was still struggling with how to protect personal data of persons, and found that in this case, in fact, the right to privacy was not breached. And the reason that the court invoked was that the data were not put in an automated processing system, so the right to privacy could not be harmed in this case. I think if we would have something similar, depending on other criteria of national law, I'm not sure if the court would come to a similar conclusion. But now, with the fundamental rights of the Charter in Europe, we have not only the court in Strasbourg anymore, who is deciding about the right to privacy, but we have also the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg, who is now obliged to apply Article 7 and 8 of the Charter. And I think we come to a whole new area of application of privacy and data protection. And we already have two very nice examples of last year. Someone of you Probably some of you have heard about the Google Spain case. Raise your hand. The Google Spain case. I'll explain. You probably have learned about it. But the Google Spain case was a case that was decided by the court in Luxembourg and was applying Article 7 and 8 together from the Charter in a case where a person in Spain had in the 80s problems for not paying certain social security debts, I think, and some of his goods were confiscated, and there was a law in Spain stating that there had to be publicity in such case. So a newspaper published that this person's goods were confiscated because he did not pay his debts and so on. In the meantime, that person had paid his debts, but when he used his name, or when his name was Googled through the Google search engine, everyone, as one of the first results, got this publication about the seizure of his goods in Spain in the 80s, although he already longly paid his debts and he wanted to continue with his life and his business, and found that his right to privacy and data protection was not respected. So after long procedures, very important and powerful procedures, because it was against Google, the court in Luxembourg found last year, by applying the fundamental right to data protection, that in fact it was not relevant that this information showed up for all searches under the name of that person, so that the right to data protection and privacy was not respected because data who were no longer relevant were processed by Google. So Google is obliged to remove that information, and now everyone and in all member states you have the possibility, and Google has put up a procedure where people who find their right to privacy or data protection harmed to file a request with Google to remove some of the information that can show up in the Google searches. That was one important case which you see has important consequences for all the member states, and also got quite easily before the court because there were the courts in Spain who actually asked a prejudicial question to the court in Luxembourg: what do we have to do here with this claim of that person? How do we have to apply Article 7 and 8? So these procedural questions, prejudicial questions that can be asked to the court, can speed up these cases very fast. Another very important case, I mentioned it quickly, is a digital rights violent case. Someone has heard about that. It's important in the forensics use because it was a directive, so a legislation from Europe, directive of 2006, that obliged all the providers of public electronic communication networks and services to keep traffic data for a certain period. So it's also called the retention directive. So in all member states, the public network and services communication providers have to store this information. And the court has looked into this obligation, which was into the directive, which was contested by Digital Rights in Ireland and movements in Ireland, who said that this directive, which obliged to keep all this information, was again against Article 7 and 8. So the court has looked into it and said that obliging to keep all this information, traffic data they call it, it is about who or which subscriber is calling to whom, which subscriber, at what time, for how long. So keeping all this information available for possible access to law enforcement, which reveals a lot of information about who is in contact with whom, also by the use of mobile services, at what location are these services used, All this is in very is disclosing lot of information and allows, and I cite the court, precise conclusion of habits, place of residence, social relationships. And in the end, the court decided that this European legislation was not necessary and proportionate for the aim of prosecution of criminal offenses. So the situation now, the directive is invalid. However, in all member states, there is national law who has implemented this legislation. So we'll have to see where this goes. But what you need to keep in mind is, in fact, that we now have two courts who are going to apply these two articles, refreshed and renewed, I would say, from the previous article from the European Convention, and two other cases to come in the coming years, maybe this year, but it's too early, or the year thereafter, is about two important public discussions again. And one case that is pending now is about the use of passenger name records and the exchange to Canada, because the European Parliament has asked, has referred that to the courts in Luxembourg, and is about safe harbor. But we see two highest courts are going to implement these principles. I will not explain how it is regulated, how to have consistency in these decisions, because we already see that Strasbourg implements slightly different criteria than Luxembourg, but it is provided that Luxembourg, in the end, that the European Union as such will become a member from the European Convention of Human Rights, so that all these interpretations have to be consistent. So, a long introduction into these two fundamental rights, and let's take a look at the text of Article 8 for confusion. In the Charter, Article 8 is about the right, the fundamental right for data protection. So if we take a look, it is the right is very simple, just as the right to privacy. Very simple, and it says everyone is entitled or has the right to protection of privacy. That's Article 7. And this article, Article 8, states everyone has the right to protection of personal data concerning him or her. So that's the fundamental right, nothing more, nothing less. Although paragraph 2 and 3 are a bit more specific, and as already I mentioned, the purpose specification principle, it is repeated there in paragraph 2. So the data must be processed fairly, and this fairly is also something that is open for further interpretation and what it exactly means, but for specified purposes. So we have there again, purpose specification is very important. And the other elements of paragraph 2 are that you either need a consent or another legitimate basis laid down by law, and that everyone has the right of access. So you remember the three principles for which exemptions exist, for example, for criminal offense prosecution, are mentioned, in fact, in this article on fundamental right of data protection. So the third paragraph states compliance of these rules are subject to control by an independent authority. And there we need to know that the present situation is that we have in 28 member states 28 different national authorities, so-called data protection authorities. And these privacy commissions, I would say, they all have their own interpretation of data protection. Why? Because before this explicit article taken up in 2007, there was only this directive of 95, which I mentioned before. There was only this EU directive setting out data protection principles. And this is the framework for all data processing, and it applies to private entities, to universities, to research centers, to public authorities, to everyone in Europe processing data without many exceptions. I think that is quite different from the situation in other countries. For example, I just mentioned the United States, where they have not such an overall regulation. The Privacy Act of 1974 has, for example, only a limited scope for public authorities. And besides this Privacy Act of 1974 in the United States, you have very detailed regulations for very specific cases in the financial sector, in the health sector, but not this overall obligations, principles which govern personal data processing. Now, important to know is that this directive is something that had to be implemented in all of the 68 member states. And you already hear me coming. They had some discretion that had to be harmonized, but all of the member states did it a bit in their own way. Add to that the 28 data protection authorities, and we got differences in all of the member states in how to apply data protection under the directive of 95. So we got a lot of questions which over the years even have not been resolved. And one of the important questions that are still pending is, to what extent is biometric data sensitive data? There is a definition of sensitive data. Biometric data is in the directive for this moment even not defined. And one of the interesting aspects or issues is biometric data sensitive? Not resolved. In fact, discussions are right now going on this aspect, because this directive of 95 is presently under reform. Another question in our context is also interesting. To what extent is a face biometric data? Some say faces, sensitive data, biometric data. It is not clear. It is important to know that definitions of biometric data are now being discussed and debated. And I'll say later a few words on that. So before this article, we had only this directive of 95, implemented in all 28 member states in different ways by different national data protection authorities, by national courts. And now with these two articles we just described, we have lifted it to a higher level and will have more consistent interpretation of what is privacy, what is data protection. And it's very important to realize that, because many, many discussions between member states, between company and state A and company B, is based on completely different perceptions and ideas about privacy. And I just give some examples. The idea of privacy is in some member states even not put in the constitution. And in France, if the idea of privacy is to be explained in legal text, they refer to the Declaration of 1789. And you still find in court decisions where they refer to the legal basis of privacy, it goes back to the Declaration in 1789. In UK, privacy in France, it is also based on the idea of freedom, is being free from interference with your personal life. So the idea of freedom is prevailing in France. In the UK, privacy is about breach of confidentiality. It's a completely different approach. It's also not, England, for example, has even not implemented Article 8 of the European Convention that I mentioned. So in England, you have a privacy problem, not when you collect, because you can collect more or less everything what you want, but it's only when it is disclosed to a third party and it's not authorized, or you breached confidence, someone thought that you would not disclose it, that you can have a privacy problem. And then in Germany, it's again a different approach. It's on the personality rights, as explained in the constitution. So you had all these different approaches, which now hopefully will become more harmonized due to the application by the highest courts in Strasbourg and Luxembourg of Article 7 and Article 8 of the Charter. Now, fundamental rights, especially of privacy data protection, they are not absolute. You can make exceptions to that. And important again is that the exceptions are also put forward in the Charter. And the components of the exceptions that I like you to keep in mind are that there needs to be a law, that there has to be a general interest or rights of others, and why, and then necessity and proportionality. So why would there have to be a need for law? Anyone an idea? Why do we want a need for an exemption or interference with fundamental rights? Anyone? The idea of the need for a law is for excluding arbitrary restrictions or interferences with fundamental rights. So the law needs to allow to know exactly in which situations your rights are intervened with. So it's for predictability. General interests can be public security. It includes also, as I mentioned, prevention and prosecution of crime. And then the two magic words, which also to some extent existed under Article 8, necessity and proportionality. So you can interfere under these three conditions. And it will all be, if we discuss privacy data protection, also for research purposes, for use of large-scale systems, it will in many cases exactly go about this necessity and proportionality. Is it really necessary to interfere with the rights, and is it really in proportion with the aim of reaching your legitimate interests? And I give a couple of examples. For example, now the discussion is going on lively about the extent that passenger name records of all Europeans flying with air carriers, and that information that is stored in air reservation systems should be made available for forensic use, for serious crime and the fight against terrorism. The Commission has made proposals to make this information available, but keep in mind this is information kept by commercial entities, air carriers, that they open up this information, which is basically used to make your flight possible, that it is also used for serious crime and against terrorism. Another example of applying proportionality and necessity was in this data retention case that I mentioned, Digital Rights Ireland. The court precisely found that it was not necessary and not proportionate to keep all the traffic details and communication information, even not without storing the content. We're only talking about the traffic details, to keep that available between 6 and 2 years for law enforcement. So proportionality was there not fulfilled. And we have this discussion going on because it's the key discussion, for example, opening up all the biometric information from asylum seekers in Eurodac to, again, law enforcement for crime and terrorism. Law has made it possible that this information can be used in these specific circumstances. And the last example is the whole discussion about the e-passport biometrics. So it is used for putting into the document, but it is left to the national member states whether they want to store it in national databases or not, and to make national laws allowing national central storage, yes or no. But again, these national laws will be scrutinized under Article 7 and 8 because it's now in the Charter. So these articles will have effect on EU legislation, will have effect on national legislation, for example, for local PNR national systems or for national e-passport databases. It will have effect for all the member states in the same way, and it will also have effect on national law for prevention and detection of crime. So that's the situation where we are now. And a nice example also of this proportionality principle that was applied in a case that was in fact in Strasbourg in 2008. It was a bit too early. And I'm not sure if you know this case, but it was a nice case where there was a law in the UK on evidence collection, and where persons were arrested. And this was a case about the person S. The full name is not mentioned because it was a minor. He was 11 years old and was suspected of attempted robbery in the UK somewhere. And Mr. Marper was another guy who was suspected of harassment of his partner. Now, in both cases, they were put free again, but they were arrested and the fingerprints were taken as well as DNA samples. And they were put in a database. So in both cases, there was no conviction. So one was a minor, and the data were kept based on this law for a very long period with the aim of linking their information for any future offense. And the court has looked into this case because a claim was filed by these two persons after gone through all the national procedures just to Strasbourg. And the court stated that, in fact, it can be a legitimate aim to link these biometrics for future offenses. This can be a legitimate interest, but it is not proportionate. Why? Because for any kind of crime, people are taking their biometrics. There is no age limitations. It was retained for a longer, so access was also not regulated, so it was not proportionate. As a result, the Act has been adapted in the meantime, putting more the safeguards and the proportionality into the law, which should make a proportionate and necessary intervention with the fundamental rights and provide guarantees in that. So please keep in mind, for all acts you do with personal data, including biometric data or even more, and whether you use it for research purposes or for forensic purposes, these tests will be done or will be needed, and enforcement is, in my opinion, to come in a more harmonized way as compared to before. So, second issue I like to discuss is the pitfall in reusing data. So, most of you are handling biometric data in databases. You're owner of the data, you reused the data that you received from someone else. And the question is, what are the pitfalls possibly in reuse of biometric data? Now, for forensic purposes, it is important to recall again that exemptions have been made from the purpose specification principle. So even if particular information is available, national laws can provide that it can be used for other purposes. However, purpose specification remains very important. And what does it mean, or what are the problems with purpose specification? Well, one of the first problems is, how specific do you have to be when you describe purpose of your database? If you have a database for research and you specify it as internal research, can you use it for public, as a public database? Can you exchange it with someone else? Can you put it into a public competition? So there have been a lot of unclarities and also different ways on how it is interpreted, how you have to specify your purpose. The group of data protection authorities have, in a recent document, clarified how you have to define your purpose. So how specific you have to be. Now, as I mentioned, there are exceptions to this purpose specification principle. And one of the exceptions includes also research. So the directive provides that if data that were originally not used for research are reused for research, national member states, again, can specify in the legislation that it can be used for research under two main conditions, basic conditions. First, that it is not used for decisions of the subjects who have given their consent, and second, that there are sufficient safeguards. So I suggest that we go to four specific cases of reuse of data and see how it works. And as I mentioned, the definitions of biometric data are presently under discussion as well. I don't think I have time to go there, but with regard to the reform that goes on, the reform of the Directive 95, those who want to be kept informed, there are three documents that presently are on the table. The proposal of the Commission of 12 January 2012, you can find it on the internet, or I can give you the references. Then the amended proposal by the Parliament, that the Parliament adopted in the first reading. And both, there is a definition of biometric data. And the third most recent document is a document of 19 December of the Council, so where all the member states are discussing this proposal and have provided their amendments already. So the very interesting definitions and on biometric data and also on pseudonymized data that we want to keep an eye on. So four cases of reuse of biometric data. The first possible case is that you collect data, primary use, you initially collect and use specific data, and the question is purpose specification, you have to use it for a particular purpose, and any further use has to be compatible with it. So the question you need to ask in case of reuse of data is, my new use compatible? Easy example, you have the luck to be able to buy a new car. You go to your garage, you say, I want a new car. This car has to be delivered, so you give your name, address, and the garage will be able, for the purpose of delivering you, selling and delivering the car, to process this information about you. However, bad luck, 2 years later, apparently with the car manufactured in the period that you bought the car, there is a problem with the brakes, all the cars have to be recalled, and the garage wants to inform you thereof. Can you reuse the personal data that you received at the moment of the sale for this product recall? And there, I think in this example, if you want to have a car without defects, and in case you need to be informed of a car that has defects, this information and the use of your information will be compatible with the initial collection and use. However, another example. Suppose there is a lab in the university developing very specific material, highly confidential, has to be secured, a few people have access, and your university government decides to implement an enhanced access control. Biometric data are used, iris, for the people having access to this lab. Will it be possible? A bit later, someone thinks, well, maybe we can also use this biometric data not only for securing our access to the lab, but to see that the people come in time, so for time and attendance. Is this compatible purpose? Compatible with the first initial use of the biometric data? And the answer is likely to be no. So always, in case of reuse, a new use of data, biometric data, the first question to ask is whether the new use is in fact compatible. So there has been discussions during the reform about this compatible use, whether it has to be enlarged, whether it was not too narrow. So there have been some comments about it, but I will not have the time to further discuss that. So let's go to the second case of reuse. So you have, as I mentioned already, the case that information is collected in the private or public sector and is reused for forensic purposes, for example, fight against crime or serious crime. So, as I mentioned, the example is of PNR data, passenger name records. Can it be reused for forensic purposes? There is an exception in Article 13, and there is national law who will allow or not allow to reuse that data. So there are national PNR systems, as you may know, but the checks that has to be done will be under Article 7 and 8 of the Charter. So the necessity and proportionality in that case will be crucial. Third case of reuse of data, and now it's specifically focused on research. So data are collected initially, for example, by a company, and it has to install biometric applications, it has collected information, has client database. Can it be used for research? So it's another type of use. Is it compatible with the first one? As I mentioned, research has an exemption, provided that there are safeguards and that there are no decisions towards the data subjects. Now, the safeguards are also now put more explicitly in the reform discussions, and it is clearly stated that additional information of the biometric data has to be put separately, so separate storage of this information. And the fourth scenario, I would say, is more in the forensic research area. If you collect information from the private sector, can it be reused for forensic research, but then in the strict purpose or strict notion of improving algorithms, or just not for looking up of suspects? And I think in that case, you could fall back on the general exception for research that exists for other actors as well. However, in the last scenario, where you would say that the biometric database is kept by forensic law authorities, can be used for pure research, in my opinion, you would need national law authorizing so much. So, in this context, you can say, can a platform where you hide the information, the biometric collections, provide additional safeguards, yes or no? This is something that can be debated. Again, it will be essential that there can be no negative decisions for data subjects that are in the database, and additional safeguards. So important additional safeguards, member states impose anonymization of the data, but for biometric data, it's clear that it is not possible to anonymize the data. Oops. So my last point, I will rush in 2 minutes. It's a very interesting debate, and it's in fact about a question: how freely can we exchange our information? Can we transfer it? Are there any concerns? And I think it's very important, also based on some revelations of the last 2 years, to realize that we in Europe have a very strong protection, Article 7 and 8, as I explained, but it is not at all the case in the US. And this has been shown very clearly in the Snowden regulations, where in the Parliament, European Parliament, they have started to investigate to what extent EU nationals are to the same extent protected in the US, if they have data there or if they are there, as US nationals are protected in the EU. And I can give you very examples, but I will not do so, of legislation in the US that specifically exempts non-US persons from protection that US nationals have in the EU under several surveillance programs. So it's important to keep in mind that there is not the same protection everywhere. And for more exchange, I have been told that there are agreements being negotiated right now at the highest level in Europe, the so-called umbrella agreement for exchange between law enforcement and for other programs, but that is so secret and so restricted that very few people have access to it. And for 2 cases to come, keep an eye on that. That's about the PNR agreements. To what extent is it necessary to keep that information available for forensic use? That is something that will be decided by the court in Luxembourg. And another important case is about safe harbor. But I will conclude with, first, I hope that you have learned that if we, of course, talk about data for forensic use, there is a specific regime that applies. Second, reuse of data. It's not as simple as it seems. It's very important to make clear distinctions in what scenario you are, under which exemptions you can fall. And we probably need more safeguards on how, more guidelines on how to safeguard the data for research environments. So we're waiting for that. Everything is under review, reform, so we will have new texts maybe end of this year or later. I thank you very much for your attention. So this convention was a convention of the Council of Europe with very clear guidelines on data protection. And this, in fact, has been used as the basis for the Directive of 95. It's very, very similar. So I would say Directive 95 replaced more or less this convention of 108, but it remains valuable, it remains in force. And guidelines from the Council of Europe are still very valuable, also in the research field, in the field of law enforcement, on how to interpret these guidelines. Thank you. I think we need to find this balance again, and to some extent it's similar to making all this communication data available for further law enforcement. So PNR data and all this traffic information, keeping it available unlimitedly for every citizen for long periods, you have to find the balance.
So now it's time for the poster session. I kindly request all the authors to make a line here. So yours is number 5?
Okay.
Slides probably. I will be more interested. Okay, so idea of the spotlight presentation is that like authors will present for 2 minutes about their contribution for the paper, and later on we all move to the poster session where we can have extensive discussion on the papers. So I start with the first author. So database, and it's
also very close to state of the art of the FRGC database. Thank you. So if you want to hear more about our work, you're welcome to visit me at my poster.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm Andreas Wood from the University of Salzburg. And the topic we're dealing with is different from most of the presentations here. So most of the presentations deal with using biometric techniques in forensics, and then we do it the other way around. So we use techniques from image forensics and apply it in the biometric field. And the application in the biometric field is we want to do biometric sensor authentication based on sensor fingerprints of the data. So we want to link the data to the actual sensor and check if the data has been really acquired with the sensor detection. And then we're using digital image forensics for that. And when doing that, we found that in the Indicatia version 4 Iris database, there are some strange effects going on, which suggest that this database was acquired with different sensors, also in the sub-databases. And this work is about analyzing the Indicatia version 4 database. So we propose some new techniques for checking how many sensors have been actually used to acquire a specific sub-database, and then the results show that the techniques which are introduced in the paper outperform some techniques that have been published. If you want to learn about which techniques, we suggest this come to us.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lars Wimmer from the University of Göttingen, and we did a performance evaluation of fingerprint orientation field reconstruction methods. And we're interested in the orientation field of a fingerprint, but we're in a situation where only the Minutia template is available. We reconstruct the fingerprint orientation field using four different methods: Ross, Shaw, and Jane from 2007, Cheng, Tsu, and Yang from 2009, at Alpha from 2011 and Peng and Chen from 2011. We did this using grassroots information and compared them using the average deviation, the percentage of pixels with an error greater than 15 degrees, the root mean square deviation, and the computational runtime. The results are that Peng and Chen is most accurate, measured in all error metrics. Shen, Tsu, and Yang is considerably faster at the possible accuracy. Ross, Shaw, and Chen isn't comparable because it has a huge computational runtime. And as you can see, hopefully, on the picture, the basic problem in all of this is that the core is estimated kind of wrong in all. So that's it. If you want to see the details, come to the poster.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Patrick Boos. You have heard a lot about fingerprints today. You just heard something about face, iris, fingerprint again. My presentation will be on something completely different, on the behavioral biometric and identification of the forensics, which is called keystroke dynamics. I am, as you see, not the first author on the list, so I'm not the most knowledgeable on this topic. I must admit that beforehand. I'll keep it short. The interesting information will be available at the poster, so that's a trigger to come and talk to me. But what we use is various features in keystroke dynamics. Well, we have timing information available on when a person presses a key and when a person releases a key, and we can derive some features from that. And we look at these features to see if they follow some power laws and if we can use that information to determine if the person behind the keyboard is actually a human or if it's a machine. So.
One of the major criticism I get, can you go to the previous slide? Are you in the chat? Yes. No. Okay. Well, the major criticism I get when I speak about 3D face recognition to people working in forensic biometrics, well, you know, in a police department we always take mug shots, we don't take 3D faces, so why are you boring us with 3D faces? That's not true, for two main reasons. There are police departments that are starting to set up equipment to actually acquire 3D faces instead of mug shots. One example is, for example, the police department in Brisbane, Queensland, and another one, I think it's the Dutch police as well. But there is, this is not the only reason. The other reason is that from mugshots you can easily get a 3D profile of the face. So you can actually reconstruct a 3D profile of the face from the mugshots. Now the poster that is described here proposes a method to match 3D profiles which can be used in a variety of applications. So the idea is to extract a number of stable points by means of a scale space analysis in 3D. So finding the highest curvature point and then using moving frame theory to find the registration between the two 3D scalps. The difference in the registration basically is a matching score. By the way, a byproduct of the scale space theory of the peculiar point found and the invariants which are associated with point triples is to get a signal which can be also used for matching. Some results are reported in poster, so you can come and get it.
Thank you.
Baseline results because what in forensic scenarios is starting to occur is that we have also handwriting information done not only with a pen or stylus but also with a fingerprint when you use your smartphone or your tablet and you want to, you don't have a pen, or you want to be, to have a universal application in which finger as an input can be used. So we are also comparing baseline results of all these possibilities, including devices and this kind of input.
Thank you. So we thank all the presenters. So we can now move to the poster area. So in case you have a confusion to find, then you can follow the volunteers here.